Hello again, Redbeard here in the studio with the stories behind history's greatest rock albums. Today, in the studio, the story of the Canadian quintet who combined talent, hard work, and a little luck into an early 80s classic. Everybody's working
for the weekend. And we drove up in the bus and our name was on the lights. I went, yeah, this looks hot. That's an album cover right there, pal. And we went in and we had like our own dressing room. I think there was even like a star on the door. We were pretty impressed. And there was like a deli tray. Ooh, you know you've made it when you get a deli tray, right? And more than one variety of beer. And then you know you're like on your way up. I hope you're with me. I hope you're with me
when it's over. And then without a break, we went into headlining in January of 82. And we must have done 250 shows. At least 250 shows around North America. We went to Europe a couple of times. I went to Japan once. Had to be 250 or maybe 300. It was a lot. We played a lot. Hey everybody, this is Paul Dean from Loverboy.
This is Mike Reno from Loverboy in the studio.
When guitarist Paul Dean met singer Mike Ranosky at the Refinery Nightclub in Calgary, Alberta, Canada in 1979, punk rock had pretty much torn a hole in the side of the rock and roll battleship like a torpedo and then blown itself up. The dying embers of disco had left some indelible marks on music production, and modern rock, called new wave by some, was emerging as the ultimate winner, with its eagerness to share some space with electronic keyboards as well as guitars. And for the first time since Elvis recorded Arthur Crudup's That's All Right Mama, blues-based riffs would not be cool in this brave new musical world at the dawn of the 80s decade. Paul Dean had just left the band Streetheart. Mike Ranosky had been the singer for a Toronto band called Moxie, but he found himself working construction back in Calgary. Paul Dean begins the story of how his luck was about to change with Loverboy.
Well, I'd just been let go of Streetheart, and I was in Calgary just sort of getting over the shock of being fired, and I figured, well, that's it. I'm not going to rely on a lead singer anymore. I'm going to go solo now. I've had it. Because this is about 10 guys I'd worked with, I guess, lead singers through the years. And I was playing bass in a band, just trying to make some Christmas money so I could buy some Christmas presents. And I was playing bass for 2 weeks in this bar band. And while we were rehearsing that, Mike came down just to hang out because he knew the guitar player in the band. And they'd played in a band earlier. And that's when I met him. We got to know each other a little bit. And after I'd finished playing bass, finished that gig, I came back to Calgary where he still was, and we started talking and started writing together, and we wrote a couple songs the first time we got together. That's the funny thing about Mike. Every time we get together, we're pretty assured to come up with one or two songs. About 4 hours later, we got a song pretty much complete, set for maybe a verse or two, but it's a real magic thing when I don't know if they're any good, but at least we write something, you know?
We'll be right back. That's Loverboy from their self-titled debut with Turn Me Loose, released in the U.S. in November 1980. Now, regardless of what VH1 writer Vinnie Ciccolini would have you believe in the liner notes of the recent Loverboy We Are the 80s compilation, that Loverboy debut would not quickly go double platinum, end quote. First of all, that first Loverboy album, it stiffed in America for the first 4 months it was out. Lead singer Ranosky had changed his name to Mike Reno, but that didn't help Loverboy get any airplay initially in the States.
We had a real tough time getting this group to be listened to in the States. We got on this tour, basically unknown, the music unknown, the audiences were going wild, and we were so choked that there was no records being sold in the record store, so we went to find out why, and none of the record stores even had the bloody record. So nobody was taking the initiative to make the records. They signed the group, but they weren't making the records. You know, they cost money to make the records, I guess. They didn't know if they should do it. And radio stations were just starting to get requests because they saw us in concert. So we had to basically go out there and really kick it, like door-to-door salespeople. And it was very, very frustrating because it's such a big machine. And like, how do five guys from Western Canada get these guys attention? And the only way I could figure it out was maybe say something to Rolling Stone. And I got in a bit of trouble for that, but I think I got my message across.
The reason Loverboy had trouble getting their record company to show a little enthusiasm may have been due to the fact that no one at Columbia Records knew exactly what to make of this band. Here's guitarist Paul Dean.
We had no idea what our image was. My only idea was I wanted to be bright. And just wear real bright colors that denoting fire, you know. I saw a band play here in town, and I saw them at one of the theaters here, and they had a lot of yellow lights and red lights, and they were all wearing bright oranges and reds and yellows. I think this is great. I'm gonna steal this idea. Plus, the cars were doing this uniform thing at the time too. This red, black, and white. So I figured, well, let's have a uniform. You know, not as strict as it was in the '60s when I was in those R&B bands and everybody wore the same suits. But let's try and get a theme going. So that was the only real image we had, was okay. Let's wear red and yellow and maybe a bit of black or a bit of white or whatever, you know. But let's try and keep the fire colors alive. I guess knowing that The Kid Is Hot was a possible single too.
We heard he opened up a brand new door.
Loverboy lead singer Mike Reno.
We were really into creating a new scene at that point. I think, and you'll hear that in the lyrics, like, the kid is hot tonight, you know, we just heard of a brand new wave. It was all this new wave music, but we were trying to stay rocky. I was never really big on listening to a lot of music at that time. I was really trying to concentrate on writing songs and having my own identity. And I think that's it helped, because I think Loverboy did have a different sound, and it wasn't like anybody else's.
Taking a shot at the pop star a full 20 years prior to American Idol, that's Loverboy with The Kid Is Hot Tonight. Since Loverboy didn't have a strong image initially, they had no preconceptions of what their first album cover should look like. As a result, the woman who was chosen to come up with the artwork wound up giving them a cover that you would expect on a Velvet Underground or 1970s Lou Reed album. Mike Reno was philosophical about it.
The album cover for the Loverboy's first album was pretty weird, I must admit. That's kind of why I liked it, though. It's like, I couldn't tell if it was a guy or a girl, which says to me, well, that's interesting. But it was weird, and I always was wondering if people were going to bug us about calling the group Loverboy. We never got bugged about that, but we did get a lot of people asking us if that was a guy or a girl on the front cover. But it didn't really matter that much to anybody. I think the music had its certain toughness to it. Nobody questioned it. Nobody ever thought the group was effeminate or anything, you know? Which is great, because I would have hated getting bugged about that. That would have really bugged me.
Loverboy founding guitarist, songwriter, Paul Dean.
I know a lot of people must have been pretty amazed when they heard the music, you know, because outside it, I would say it denoted a new wave band, but we had a bit of that, as they called it in those days, a bit of a new wave sound. The Cars were a big influence for the band, and in my writing and Doug's writing and that. But even so, when you open it up and there's Teenage Overdose and Turn Me Loose and Always On My Mind, hardly a new wave sound. With a new wave look, it must have been a little bit confusing for people.
Surprise, it's always the same. Every
That's called When It's Over, from Loverboy's second album, Get Lucky. We'll get the story on that coming up next, along with how drummer Matt Frenette brought four-on-the-floor drumming to rock and roll. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Loverboy's Get Lucky.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Dean from Loverboy, and let's get lucky in the studio.
Thanks, Paul. This is the anniversary of that album. I'm Redbeard. It took 6 months for the first Loverboy album to catch on in the U.S., but it finally got the attention of American radio, and it went on to sell 4 million copies to date. Loverboy jumped on every tour they could get as an opening act that year. Just before Thanksgiving 1981, I introduced them on stage in Memphis as the opener for Point Blank. The first song that Loverboy played blew me and the audience away, but it wasn't on their debut. So I rushed backstage after their show, and I asked Paul Dean, that song about working for the weekend, where'd that come from?
I remember writing that tune in Montreal. When we were just playing a bar out there, just one night, it just came to me, you know, here we go, here's another one. That sounds a little glib, but I mean, I was really amazed that it, you know, it felt great when the tune came out. All the parts just sort of clicked. Remember the first time we played it live at rehearsal one day, and it was just, this is it, this is the one. Just how good it felt when we played it the first time.
Come out tonight.
Loverboy's Paul Dean, who co-wrote Working for the Weekend.
I'll tell you how another indication that I had on the strength of that tune. We were playing a bar in Nanaimo. It's a small town here just outside of Vancouver. And it's a three-set kind of thing. So we played the first set and then the second set, and it's kind of at least up until that point, it was a real meat market. Nobody was dancing. Everybody was looking each other over and just getting drunk and that. And we, I'm going, God, is this place ever going to happen? So the third set comes along, and we open the first set with Working for the Weekend, and immediately the dance floor filled, and I figured, well, we must be doing something with this tune. Here it's definitely clicking.
It definitely did click. With Working for the Weekend, Loverboy's Get Lucky album got off to a fantastic start, winding up in the top 10, staying on the charts for 122 weeks, and eventually selling more than 4 million copies.
When we released the first album, and we started touring, we toured straight with, we did, the four major tours were April Wine, Kansas, ZZ Top, and Journey. And that had to have been close to 200 shows, I would say. Or 150 anyway, for sure, 150. That was in a row. And then we recorded the album in 5 weeks, the second album in 5 weeks, and we're back on the road immediately. It was probably the fastest pressing ever done by Columbia to get it in the stores by the time we went out with Journey. And then we did, I think it was 60 dates with Journey. And then without a break, we went into headlining in January of 82. And we must have done 250 shows. At least 250 shows around North America. We went to Europe a couple of times and went to Japan once. Had to be 250 or maybe 300. It was a lot. We played a lot. And a lot of the times when we were warming up before we were doing headlines, we were doing, every time there was a day off, every time the headliners would take a day off, we'd be out playing bars, just trying to get anything we can, any kind of little bit of recognition and publicity, and get a record sold here or a tape sold there. We were happy, make another convert. I think before we knew that we were going to start recording the album, we knew that we had the possibility of getting the Journey tour starting October the 6th. So that was, and I think we finished the ZZ tour in the end of July. So we figured, all right, well, let's make this deadline. So we knew about that when we were on the road. I remember rehearsing in the washrooms. We used to set up the drums and bring a little amp in, and we'd set up our little ghetto blaster to record into. And I can vividly remember rearranging Lucky Ones and Watch Out in the washrooms after the sound check, before the set, just trying to get ready for that next album, trying to make that Journey deadline, because we knew that, if we get this tour, figuring at least that Working for the Weekend was going to do something, let's not waste this opportunity. Let's try and grab this Journey tour, because that's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I think we had something like 60 dates.
Now, one thing that made Working for the Weekend move was the right foot of drummer Matt Frenette, who co-wrote the song, and he revolutionized rock drumming by borrowing from dance music. Now, you see, rather than hit the bass drum on every other beat, a typical rock and roll rhythm, Frenette would kick it on all four beats, which is a technique that Loverboy called four on the floor. This driving beat made Loverboy's hard rock tunes quite danceable, and was subsequently copied by many rock timekeepers. Once again, here's Loverboy singer Mike Reno.
I don't even realize until someone like yourself mentions it. Like, we needed we tried a lot of different things when we're writing a song, but the thing we thought worked best and just drove it right down your throat was four on the floor. And so we just used to look at Maddie and give him the old thumbs up and say, four on the floor, pal, this will go great. And sure enough, because our music was so far from disco, it didn't matter if we had four on the floor, because we were just out there to kick some butt. And I think four on the floor was necessary to get our point across. And nobody plays four on the floor better than Maddie.
Would you ride deer to meet me like this, sneaking around with a
From Get Lucky, that's Loverboy with Jump, co-written by fellow Canadian countrymen Bryan Adams and Jim Vallance. When we come back, we'll find out how singer Mike Reno first found out in practical terms how Loverboy was on the way to the top. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Loverboy's Get Lucky.
Hey, everybody. This is Paul Dean from Loverboy.
This is Mike Reno from Loverboy in the studio.
Thanks, guys. I'm Redbeard, and this is the anniversary of that second Loverboy album, Get Lucky. As their popularity began to take off, there were many indicators that Loverboy was about to hit the big time. But to singer Mike Reno, none was more telling than the buying habits of young concert goers.
The biggest thing I remember is when people were buying our T-shirts, I just went, well, now that is happening. You know, because I know everybody likes to rock. You know, I'd pay to go see a good rock band anytime, but I wouldn't necessarily buy their T-shirt, right? But when they started buying our T-shirts, I just went, whoa, we're there, dude. And I don't remember. I was just sitting here trying to think, when was the first time I looked up and saw the lights? I remember we did a thing at the Agora, and we drove up in the bus, and our name was on the lights, and I went, yeah, this looks hot. That's an album cover right there, pal. And we went in and we had like our own dressing room. I think there was even like a star on the door. We were pretty impressed. And there was like a deli tray. Ooh, you know you've made it when you get a deli tray, right? And more than one variety of beer. And then you know you're like on your way up.
I have
Take Me to the Top from Get Lucky, Loverboy's top 10 seller second album. In April of 1982, Loverboy was honored with 6 Juno Awards. That's Canada's answer to the Grammys. Among the awards received that night were Junos for the Best Producer and Best Engineering. At the time, nobody knew that Bruce Fairbairn, the man who produced Get Lucky with guitarist Paul Dean, and Bob Rock, one of the Get Lucky engineers, would someday be two of the most sought-after producers in all of rock and roll. But Mike Reno of Loverboy could see it coming from a mile away.
I felt great when John Bon Jovi phoned Paul and said, "Who's your producer? And can I have his number?" Paul told me that, and I just went, "That's cool." And Bon Jovi came to town to record. Next thing, and they got this gigantic album, Slippery When Wet, using Bob Rock and Bruce Fairbairn, our producer and engineer. The studio was constantly booked. I mean, at one point I even got mad because I wanted to go and cut a couple of songs. I couldn't get in there because on one side is Poison, and on the other side is Aerosmith. And when Aerosmith left, AC/DC was coming in before David Lee Roth came up and did his record, and then White Snake were there, and Motley Crue was on the other side, and I was just going, "Hold it. We started this. Everybody out of the studio. I want to cut a couple of tracks here." But, you know, I just feel proud. Vancouver's a great city. The studio's a great studio. And the guys we worked with are fabulous guys. Good, hardworking guys. It's like the Canadian ethic, you know?
When all was said and done, Loverboy had themselves a massive hit with the Get Lucky album. It enjoyed worldwide sales of 4 million copies, received multiple Juno Awards, broke the top 10 on the album charts, stayed on the charts for 122 weeks, and gave the world 4 on the floor drumming. Also, producers Bruce Fairbairn and Bob Rock went on to fabulous things with people like Aerosmith and Metallica and Bon Jovi. But even to this day, Mike Reno, who sang all those big hits for Loverboy, knows that although they called the album Get Lucky, luck had very little to do with it.
Luck is one of those things. I mean, you have to have everything going. It's just like to make a good fist, you got to have all the fingers, you know? And I guess that's part of luck. We were very fortunate, but we got kicked a few times. I mean, we weren't as lucky as some groups, but we were persistent. Somehow we just kept at it. We had a lot of good people out there that supported us. I mean, we were lucky when it comes to that, knowing the right people. So we had a lot of help.
It's Lucky Ones from Loverboy's Get Lucky on its anniversary. Their luck ran out in November 2000 when Loverboy bassist Scott Smith was washed overboard off the California coast and presumed drowned. Producer Bruce Fairbairn also died suddenly at age 59. Despite these losses, Loverboy played a 25th anniversary tour as recently as 2005. I'm Redbeard.